You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Ten years after his death, Roberto Bolaño's name rings much louder than an echo. He is alive in many ways beyond his words. Hailed as the voice of Latin American contemporary literature, the Chilean poet and writer left us at the young age of 50. His 60th birthday would have been just 2 weeks ago, but not without an immense body of work that to this day is still being uncovered. He spent most of his life as a poet, and only in his final years shifted to prose, leaving us, among other fiction, two epics that have defined the last decade, The Savage Detectives and 2666. His work is riddled with the complexities of his contrarian world. Through Chile, Mexico, and Spain, he fed himself with literature, chasing dreams and shadows, creating ghosts and perverse fantasies. Even after his death, we continue to read his words, with unfinished work still being published. Perhaps that is because his own story is unfinished, the one that we, his readers, are still writing. That is our prompt tonight, and the voices who will contribute to the discussion are the ones who hear the echoes and see the shadows, who have given meaning to the words. A publisher, a critic and writer, a poet and translator, and a Bolaño biographer give shape to what was and what will be of this man, this myth, this Roberto Bolaño. Tonight we are joined by Monica Maristain, editor, journalist, and writer. In 2010, she published the last interview conducted with Bolaño, included in New Directions' posthumous publication, Between Parentheses, available for sale tonight. She is the author of the 2012 Bolaño biography, El Hijo de Mr. Playa, Una Semblanza de Roberto Bolaño. Monica joins us from Mexico tonight, and she just made it to the library from LAX. And we're so happy to have her. And she'll also be speaking tomorrow at Leala. Barbara Epler is editor-in-chief, president, and publisher of New Directions, an independent publisher founded in 1936, based in New York City. Barbara is responsible for introducing Bolaño to the American market with the English publication of his novella, By Night in Chile. New Directions publishes about 40 new books a year, including fiction and poetry in translation, as well as American experimental poets. Ben Ehrenreich is a journalist and the author of two novels. He has reported from Afghanistan, Haiti, Cambodia, all over the Americas, and most recently, Palestine. He is a recipient of the 2011 National Magazine Award in feature writing, and his essay on Bolaño, Appearing and Disappearing Like True Poetry, can be found on our website. David Shook, poet and translator, studied endangered languages in Oklahoma and poetry at Oxford. His debut poetry collection, Our Obsidian Tongues, explores the multiplicity of voices that inhabit Mexico City. He has translated the novellas of Mexican author Mario Bellatin, the Zapotec poetry of Victor Terran, and the Infrarealist Manifesto by Roberto Bolaño. And moderating our conversation this evening is the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hector Tobar of the Los Angeles Times, where he has worked for nearly 20 years. Hector is currently a book critic at the Times and is the author of three books, including the award-winning novel, The Barbarian Nurseries. Let's give a round of applause to tonight's panelists.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you to Aloud and to the Central Public Library for having us. This wonderful event in celebration of a dead writer. A very unusual event, and yet one that's appropriate to a city that values so much literature and especially its Spanish-speaking roots. And in talking with Maureen before this and talking with some of our panelists, it seemed that we wanted to bring, you know, Don Roberto to the event. And unfortunately, we couldn't quite fit a Ouija board here or have a seance. But we decided that we should have his voice in this event somehow. And so we decided with David that we would read a little bit of his work, a very short passage of his work. And David, can you tell us a little bit about this particular piece that we're going to read and where it comes from and when it was written?
Certainly. This is Bolaño's Infrarealist Manifesto. It's called Leave Everything Again, after a Breton quote. And he wrote it when he was very young, in 76, which would have made him probably 23. I'm not sure what time of year he wrote it, but it's in the spirit of the Latin American avant-garde, Orozero from Peru, and a lot of those guys. He incorporates even lyrics from Patti Smith, from the Mexican rock band Los OVNIs. And it's a glimpse into the mind of a very young Roberto Bolaño.
And I'm going to read in Spanish, yo voy a leer en el castellano, y David en inglés. Entonces, esto no necesitan los, you don't need the headphones for this. No, you don't need the if you're listening to the translation. Nuestros parientes más cercanos, los francotiradores, los llaneros solitarios que asolan los cafés de chinos de Latinoamérica, los destazados en supermarkets, en sus tremendas disyuntivas individuo-colectividad, la impotencia de la acción y la búsqueda a niveles individuales o bien enfangados en contradicciones estéticas de la acción poética.
Our closest relatives, the sniper, the solitary plainsman that pillaged the Chinese cafes of Latin America, the supermarket butchers in their tremendous disjunctive individual collectivism, the impotence of action and the search at individual levels are all muddy with aesthetic contradictions for poetic action.
Y la buena cultura burguesa, y la academia, y los incendiarios, y las vanguardias, y sus retaguardias, y ciertas concepciones del amor, el buen paisaje, la colt precisa y multinacional? Como me dijo Saint-Just en un sueño que tuve hace tiempo, hasta las cabezas de los aristócratas nos pueden servir de armas.
And good bourgeois culture, and the academy and arsonists, and the vanguards and their rear guards, and certain conceptions of love, nice scenery, the precise and multinational cult. Like Saint-Just told me in a dream I had a while ago, even the heads of the aristocrats can serve us as weapons.
Repito, el poeta como héroe develador de héroes, como el árbol rojo caído que anuncia el principio del bosque. Los intentos de una ética estética consecuente están empedrados de traiciones o sobrevivencias patéticas. Y es que el individuo podrá andar 1,000 kilómetros, pero a la larga el camino se lo come. Nuestra ética es la revolución, nuestra estética la vida, una sola cosa.
I repeat, the poet as hero, developer of heroes, as the fallen red tree that announces the beginning of the forest. The attempts at a consistent ethic aesthetic are paved in betrayal or pathetic survivals. And the individual can journey 1,000 kilometers, but in the long run, the path will eat him. Our ethic is revolution. Our aesthetic is life, one soul thing.
Las galaxias del amor están apareciendo en la palma de nuestras manos. Poetas, suéltense las trenzas, si tienen. quemen sus porquerías y empiecen a amar hasta que lleguen a los poemas incalculables. No queremos pinturas cinéticas, sino enormes atardeceres cinéticos. Caballos corriendo a 500 kilómetros por hora, ardillas de fuego saltando por árboles de fuego. Una apuesta para ver quién pestañea primero entre el nervio y la pastilla somnífera.
The galaxies of love are appearing in the palm of our hands. Poets, let your hair down, if you have it. Burn your crap and begin to love until you arrive at incalculable poems. We don't want kinetic paintings, but enormous kinetic sunsets. Horses running at 500 kilometers per hour. Squirrels of fire jumping over trees of fire. A bet to see who blinks first between will and sleeping pill.
So that's Don Roberto Bolaño. May he rest in peace. And also that's a wonderful reminder of the importance of translation. And that's a really beautiful translation. David, thank you, you know, for that. Thank you also. And so I'd like to begin our panel. Only one of us here actually, a couple of the people on the panel actually corresponded with Bolaño. But we've all sort of come to know this writer. And when you read when you spend however long it takes to read 2666, and it's taken me a couple of months to read it, you feel like you get to know a person. But my first question to our panelists is, how did you come to know? Comenzamos con Mónica. ¿Cómo es que conociste y la obra y la persona de Roberto Bolaño?
Bueno, antes que nada quería decir que cuando te referías a traerlo a Roberto como medium, se comenta siempre que todo alrededor de Bolaño se bolañiza. Hay muchas anécdotas que podría contar al respecto, no quiero robar mucho tiempo, pero una de ellas la viví yo cuando yo soy argentina y vivo en México, y en México se hacen altares los días de muertos. Cuando el año que murió Roberto, se me ocurrió hacer un altar y puse la foto de Roberto al lado del Che Guevara. Y cuando volví a mi casa estaban los bomberos, se había quemado la casa.
Oh no. My God.
Esas cosas pasan con Bolaño. Así que yo no lo convocaría.
Cuidado. Pues esta biblioteca ya se quemó una vez.
Por eso.
I was reminding her that this library already burned down once. So
lo conocí a Roberto cuando yo trabajaba en la revista Playboy. Era la coeditora y luego fui la editora. Y entonces estaba obsesionada con que escribiera un cuento para la revista. Una de las secciones más conocidas de Playboy no son las chicas, no son las Playmates. Es el cuento inédito del escritor, obviamente. Y lo llamé por medio de Santiago Gamboa, un escritor colombiano. Me dijo, bueno, lo voy a llamar y le voy a preguntar si lo puedes llamar. Y me atendió con su característica voz y me dice, ah, Mónica de Playboy. Sí, ya me dijo Santiago. Y ahí empezó una relación muy, muy rica. Decía que nunca me iba a mandar el cuento, entre otras cosas porque Playboy nunca pagaba. Tenía razón, nunca pagaba. Y fue una relación muy intensa de cartas y de llamadas telefónicas. Una relación que ha repetido con mucha gente. Somos en ese aspecto poco originales, ¿no? Era un hombre muy generoso con su afecto. Y poco tiempo antes de morir me propuso él hacer una entrevista. Me dice, a ver Maristain, me decía Maristain, ¿por qué no me haces una de esas entrevistas frívolas y provocadoras que tú haces? Y así fue. Fueron 100 preguntas hechas así como en trance prácticamente. Nunca me pasó una cosa igual. Y él contestó magníficamente, ¿no? Es decir, era una relación extraña que te permitía preguntarle a un escritor como periodista si tenía una patineta cuando era chico. Porque sabía que lo que te iba a contestar era genial.
Claro.
Y fue genial, ¿no? Es decir, era un escritor que le podías preguntar por qué lleva siempre la contraria y él te contestaba, no, yo nunca llevo la contraria, ¿no? Así que así fue, así fue.
Y él refirió a esta entrevista que podría ser una entrevista que se publicara después de su muerte, ¿no? Él sabía.
Bueno, él me escribió de luego varios correos pidiéndomela para el Mercurio de Chile. Y luego me contó Vila Matas, Enrique Vila Matas, el escritor, que era una de las pocas entrevistas que Bolaño había hecho en serio, porque contestaba, era un poco mentiroso respondiendo. Claro. Y esa entrevista fue como un legado, ¿no? Porque habla de su enfermedad, de su muerte inminente, de la obra póstuma, muy mal de los otros escritores, como era costumbre.
Barbara, you had a brief correspondence, right, with him. And tell us a little more about that and how you came to, you know, bring his work into English for the first time.
Well, it was brief is a little bit of an understatement. We knew we were going to publish by Night in Chile, and when I read the manuscript, I wrote him a huge fan letter and just saying that we were so thrilled that we were able to publish the book. And then, like 3 weeks later, he died. So I've heard from people that he was happy we were publishing the book, but so he never wrote me back. But I think he was very sick. And what happened a lot in publishing, I don't speak Spanish, and so I hear about authors from often other writers. And my friend, a social friend, he's actually published by Grove, Francisco Goldman, who lives part of the year in Mexico City and reads very widely and has very strong enthusiasms. And sometime in 2002, we were having drinks, and I have this cocktail napkin that was like Bolaño, like underlined. And then also on that same one is Cesar Ayra. And we ended up publishing both authors. But anyhow, so not long after that, I was out with another friend, also for drinks, and he worked at another publishing house, but he was disenchanted, and he was leaving this publishing house. He hadn't been treated very well there, and he asked me what I was thinking of, and I keep a little notebook of possibilities, because you meet so many people who have good ideas, and you don't have enough time to follow them up, especially if you can't read the languages. So I showed him this list, and he goes, Bolaño, you know what? I think there's a galley from Harville, which was a very good, when Christopher Macclehouse was running it particularly, it was a really incredibly strong English publishing house. And I'm sure that I saw a galley. It's already been translated, and no one's read it, as far as I know, at our house. And so I wrote Christopher and said, because New Directions were small and independent, and so sometimes when a British publisher is looking for a partner, they're looking for a partner with a deeper pockets and more money, and you know, you always want to get the most money you can. It's a hard business. And so I wrote Christopher, and he very kindly sent me By Night in Chile in a Galley, and I read it overnight, and I thought, oh my God, this is a very incredible book. It's not Francisco's favorite, and I know some people, it's not their favorite. I love it. Maybe it's because when you first fall in love with someone, you really love. I love this book very, very much. I know.
No, creo que es el favorito de mucha gente, del escritor Rodrigo Fresán, el argentino, gran amigo de Roberto, habló muy bien de Nocturno de Chile, es su libro favorito. Es el favorito de Jorge Volpi también. No, mucha gente ama Nocturno de Chile. Herralde también lo quiere mucho. Sí. No es tan...
Francisco's like, Francisco, who, you know, is like, oh, that's not really Bolaño. That's not a 266 distant star. Anyway, I think Bolaño is very big and has very many incredible range of abilities. But I love By Night in Chile. And so that was really terrific. And it was the first book to be published in America in English. But as it turned out, I thought we were the first publisher in America, but Grand Street, which used to be this really terrific magazine that went down, it had two lives and then died, but they'd published two stories, and one of which I'd read, Telephone Calls, and then the other one is the basis of or The Seed of Distant Star, which was the second book we published, which is a really another incredible novella. And then we were doing Last Evenings on Earth, which are the stories. And by coincidence, what really helped with Bolaño was that the editor of Grand Street went to become the fiction editor of The New Yorker. And under her tenure for the last 10 years, her name's Deborah Treisman. You'll see much more translated fiction. And she's been really terrific for world literature at The New Yorker. And The New Yorker's not for everybody, I know, but a million people see it. And so just to get the name registered, like we got a Cesar Ira story, it's just huge. So, and then, unfortunately, we got so much attention, and it was at a time when Susan Sontag was still alive, that she just, we sent her By Night in Chile, and she also read it overnight and said it's a masterpiece. And so that was a book that just broke out and everybody reviewed it. And it was really Susan who put that across. And but unfortunately, we made him famous enough that a larger publisher then got Savage Detectives in 2666. And but we went on, almost as a consolation prize, the agent at the time was like, you could have all the little books. And, but the thing about the little books is they're really huge. I mean, they're really amazing books. So
and Barbara, what is it you saw in this book when you've, you know, this is a novel that is essentially one entire long paragraph, and it's a man recounting his past and remembrances, 1950s Chile. What did you see in the book that really sort of stood out for you?
Well, the weird combination, which I think continues through everything he writes, of incredibly beautiful writing, I mean, just extraordinarily beautiful writing and completely convincing. You know, you're in the mind of this really sort of disturbed Jesuit priest who ends up teaching Pinochet about communism. I mean, it's like a very strange book, and it's a first-person narrative, but it's also extremely funny. And yet it's also, I mean, it's the wit in it is really strong. But the voice gets you, and you begin to feel sorry for a creature that you do not like at all as a person. And there are these extraordinary scenes early on of this sort of, when he's with his friend and sort of mentor, who's a literary critic. And like the way Bolaño draws the evil literary critic is just, and draws Neruda. I mean, it's just like, whoa. Anyway, you can't take your eyes off of it, or at least I couldn't. It just continued to unfold with some surrealistic things about, like, the priest that keeps the hawks to kill the pigeons because the pigeons are ruining the churches. And really strange, deeply, like, affecting, and some hallucinogenic scenes at the beginning when he's with the evil mentor, and then these two characters who involve him in this thing of teaching Pinochet, and then this the American with the torture chamber in her. I mean, she's not American, but the husband is American. And what I really knocked me out is okay, it's all. It has a great epigraph. I mean, everything about it is terrific. I think it's I think it's a perfect book. But then I didn't see what was coming. There's this boy that's haunting him, and I didn't understand the boy until literally the last few pages who that figure was, and then it has this. You know, it's one huge paragraph, and then the last paragraph is a single line, which is just, then the storm of shit began.
Oh, you gave away the ending.
I'm sorry. I mean, it's just an incredible book. I mean, it kept surprising me. So, and then it's beautiful. I mean, and it's extraordinarily translated by Chris Andrews, who's a poet himself and really did a terrific job.
And this, I understand, is one of the books, and along with Monica's, which is up for sale outside when we finish today. And it's a wonderful introduction to Bolaño for those who haven't read.
It's still fascinating, even if you know the end.
now, Ben, you're a writer whose paths have, in certain sense, crossed with Bolaño's, even though you never met him. And can you tell me a little bit about how you came to know his work and how you came to write about him? I know you've written about him, and can you tell us a little about that?
I've been trying to remember how I came to his work, and I can't remember at all. The first book I read was Distant Star, and By Night in Chile shortly after that, and it was a very strange experience because I loved them both, and they didn't seem like books that would find an enormous audience in the U.S. They're books. Both of those books are about kind of the intersections of literature and, you know, late 20th century fascism in Latin America, which is a particular interest of mine, but not of everyone's. And Very shortly thereafter, after the Savage Detectives was published, around the time that it was published, suddenly Bologna was on, you know, every mouth in town, and everybody was writing about Bologna. Francisco Goldman wrote a big piece in the New York Review. Benjamin Kunkel wrote a good, very long piece in the London Review of Books. I did some searching and counted in the last. Since 2005, when the New Yorker published their first story of Bolaños, they've published 9 stories of Bolaños. Harper's has published 7 stories of Bolaños. Many of them are excellent, but this is nonetheless like absolutely like extraordinary, right? This doesn't happen to Latin American writers in this culture, and I haven't written about this, but what I've been asking myself for the last few years is how this happened, how Bolaño was beatified and ordained. And I know I'm being a bit of a pain in the ass in taking this tack here, and I adore his work and admire his work enormously, so I don't want it to seem that I don't. But there are a lot of writers.
He could burn down the library if he wanted to. So
there are a lot of writers whose work I adore and esteem enormously, who are published in translation here and who just kind of disappear. And yet Bolaño was somehow chosen. And he became the one Latin American writer of the last 4 decades that people in the United States knew about. Garcia Marquez being the previous one, and it was sort of as if nothing had happened between those two writers, I have some theories about why Bolaño struck a nerve in American publishing circles, but I'm curious to hear what everybody else thinks, because I think there's a way in which the phenomenon that Bolaño became reveals a great deal about who we are and what we want, because it's so strange.
Well, in what sense? What's your thinking on that?
I mean, I have a few notions. I mean, one I think is doesn't reveal much about us, but Bolaño, his life gives itself to mythmaking. Mm-hmm. Certainly, in his writing, it's often very difficult to tell what's autobiographical and what's fictional. And certain things which were accepted as canonical truths of his biography have since been, others have claimed, never happened. And then there's argument about all of this. And I think he enjoyed the kind of flexibility of identity that this allowed him. And he was a fiction writer.
Yeah, and he was also someone whose identity was connected to several different countries, Chile and Mexico and Spain, right? He was an international kind of person already.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing, and I have no, I haven't done an exhaustive look at the critical literature on Bolaño by American critics, but my sense is that what made him resonate, and it was really from Savage Detectives on, mm-hmm. and particularly Savage Detectives, I think, is, how can I say this? His positioning with respect to an artistic avant-garde and to a revolutionary politics, which was with a lot of, I think superficially, a lot of irony and satire, and beneath that, I think there's a great deal of heartbreak and passion. And I think the irony is easy for Americans to accept. I mean, we live in a country in which a literary world in which it's almost impossible to imagine like people getting into fistfights over literature,
right?
Which is probably too bad. It's easy to read a book like The Savage Detectives and laugh at the hijinks of the infrarealists.
Right, because we live in this world where, you know, I mean, the writer is respected, but at the same time there's disdain towards the writer as someone who's wasting time. We live in a very practical culture, and yet here are these books where writers are almost gods and they're fought over.
And they're also, I mean, like Bolaño, you know, Bolaño, his idealism by the time he wrote these books had gotten a little crispy and complicated. But you know, he remained the man who, in his early 20s, had written "Our Ethic is Revolution, Our Aesthetic is Life," one single thing. And I think that gets lost in the way he's been received here. This sort of, which I think is something that is hard to understand outside of the context of Latin American history and Latin American literature more generally. Like the really sort of, I find a real kind of profound heartbreak at the root of a lot of his later works.
Now, David, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to know his work and how is it you came to translate this manifesto?
Yeah, I guess I got in on the game a little late, I feel like. As a poet, I'm not a big reader of fiction. I typically say if a book doesn't have to do with poetry or with sex, it can't keep my attention very long. And it just so happens that my friend Armando gave me a copy of The Savage Detectives, which features a lot of poetry and a lot of sex. And I thought, wow, this guy's pretty good. You know, I finished it, which is big for me, you know. I put it down on that list of 15 novels I've finished so far. And I found out pretty quickly, you know, I was sort of parsing through what was autobiographical and what wasn't, which I think, like Ben said, really lends itself to a mythology of the writer. And found his poetry in Spanish and soon thereafter in English. He actually has a poem about Los Angeles.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
It's just three lines long. I'll read it to you guys if you like. It's
right, and he considered himself a poet. He wrote prose was sort of a late in life thing for him. Later in life.
Yeah.
Yes. So the poem.
The poem. I dreamt of frozen detectives in the great refrigerator of Los Angeles, in the great refrigerator of Mexico City. That's it. I hope I didn't build it up too much. But I think it was my interest in his relationship to the avant-garde, especially in Latin America, that really attracted me to his poetry, and which eventually attracted me to his manifesto. And his manifesto, it's incredible. It's obviously a very young Bolaño, a Bolaño who hasn't, you know, he's just not as jaded yet. And his range to just the wide range of writers he'd read by the time he was 23 and wrote this manifesto are astounding. You know, he's quoting Kurt Schwitters, and then he's quoting, I have to look at it because the guy's so obscure. It's the Russian science fiction writer Georgi Gurevich, who wrote this obscure story in 1958 that was published in a Soviet science fiction propaganda magazine, translated into English. And then he, by all, you know, based on the research I've done, then translated that brief fragment into Spanish. I think the manifesto shows the clear influence of Oswald Giandragi's Cannibal Manifesto from, you know, good 60-something years before that. I think, you know, you see Hora Zero and the Peruvian avant-gardist, you see pataphysics. I mean, the thing is named after a quote by Breton, and the surrealists are there. I think just that wide range of reading inspired me and still inspires me. And that's what sort of sealed the deal for me. I think translating this manifesto, I'm by far Bolaño's least important and devastatingly handsomest translator. I've only done this manifesto, which appears in a very obscure British edition of Savage Detectives. And the manifesto, it's short, you know, it's a couple thousand words. And it was ridiculously hard. Bolaño uses puns. I told Hector they're bad puns. And I meant bad puns because they're bad puns, but they're also impossible to translate. He makes the translator's task very difficult. And I think even in his prose, I imagine the vastness of the literary allusions must be, you know, it requires a lot of research. It took me several weeks to figure out old Georgie's name, and I had only guessed that excerpt at the beginning of the manifesto came from Soviet science fiction, because the next line he talks about Soviet science fiction writers scratching their foreheads by candlelight. And so I wrote a friend who's a specialist, and I'd back-translated it into English, and he then, by some miracle, found the original text.
Now, we were talking before, but do you have a sense for who this character Roberto Bolaño was, that he could, where, who was this guy who read all this stuff, and where could he have possibly read all this, have read all this stuff at age 23? Was he then? Was he in Mexico City?
He's in Mexico City stealing books, basically. And, you know, I wondered, because I've heard from established Mexican poets like David Huerta, who gave a reading with Paz once, where some of the infrarealists stood up in the back. You know, I wondered if tonight we might have some contemporary infrarealists among us, you know, who would stand up and challenge Ben to a fight out in front of the library. But so far, they haven't materialized.
Well, was la persona, the person, Mónica, ahora ya 10 años después de tu entrevista, has visto cómo ha crecido este mito de Roberto. ¿Qué es la relación entre el hombre que conociste y ahora lo que es ahora, como ven, ¿no? De lo que es ya todo un mito, una industria de Bolaño? ¿Cuál es la diferencia entre las dos personas?
Bueno, yo tengo muchas opiniones y todas son muy radicales y...
Por favor.
Y un poco molestas también a veces. En primer lugar, creo que Bolaño no es culpable de su biografía. Es un mito que creció ajeno a él, esto puedo dar fe después de investigar bastante, no quiero decir que lo sé todo sobre la vida de una persona porque no es cierto, pero nunca fue consciente, sabemos que murió además muy joven, de lo que se generaba alrededor de él, digamos, ¿no? Sobre todo porque ese mito creció después de muerto. Era dueño además de una vida súper aburrida, era un hombre de ritos y de costumbres, muy, no bebía, no se drogaba, en los últimos tiempos además comía poco y se tenía que cuidar mucho porque tenía esa enfermedad congénita en el hígado que finalmente lo mató. Y yo creo que hay que sacar a Bolaño de Bolaño, ¿no? Creo que cuando se dice que en Estados Unidos el fenómeno se da por el mito que se generó alrededor de su vida, se subestima a los lectores estadounidenses. Creo que Bolaño, el gran mérito para mí como lectora de Bolaño, es el gran dibujo del mal. Somos como sociedades, tanto en Latinoamérica como en Estados Unidos o como en Europa, fruto del mal. Creo que lo que más nos conmueve de su prosa es lo que nos toca de vergüenza ajena y propia con lo que hemos hecho, ¿no? Es decir, creo que abrir 2666 es decir, ¿qué hicimos? ¿No? Creo además que hay un aspecto no estudiado de la obra de Roberto que es muy interesante y que tiene que ver con todo... con que se puede quemar esta biblioteca, que es el aspecto visionario de su literatura. Es decir, era realmente un visionario. Hay una entrevista que dio en la segunda vez que fue a Chile, en la televisión, en donde se quejaba muchísimo de la discriminación contra los homosexuales, que había en Chile. Y los que leen las noticias saben que hace un año se asesinó a golpes, pero aparte como si fueran la Edad Media, a un muchacho en Santiago de Chile, la gran capital chilena, solo por ser homosexual. Es decir, tenía estas cosas, ¿no? Ni hablar del infierno que hemos vivido en México en los últimos 6 años, con la guerra del narco, que es la política estadounidense aplicada a las drogas que compró Calderón y la impuso, que dejó 100.000 muertos. Y Bolaño escribe 2666 en 2003, ¿no?
Claro.
Entonces, creo que es un aspecto muy importante de su literatura que hace que, para resumir, creo que Bolaño, gracias a Dios, está afuera de todos los que estamos acá, de todos sus amigos, de sus viudas, de sus novias, y vive y va a vivir en las nuevas generaciones. Son las nuevas generaciones las que nos van a ayudar a leer a Bolaño, a entenderlo, a comprenderlo, a disfrutarlo, fuera de todo este fenómeno del que uno también vive, ¿no? Porque finalmente yo estoy aquí gracias a ese fenómeno. Hice un libro que se llama El hijo de Mr. Playa y es la primera biografía de Roberto por ese fenómeno, aunque debo decir que mirando a los ojos de mis compañeros de panel encuentro a mis hermanos en ese deslumbramiento que tuvimos cuando leímos por primera vez a Roberto, ¿no? Es decir, a mí me pasó con Los detectives salvajes. También una amiga que estaba harta de mí porque lloraba por algún novio y no sé qué. ¡Tómale esto!, ¿no? Y cuando leí Los detectives salvajes se transformó la visión del mundo. Y creo, para los latinoamericanos, para terminar, creo que lo que nos plantea Bolaño, y es un pecado, voy a ir al infierno por lo que voy a decir, nos ayuda a encontrarnos con Borges, nos ayuda a encontrarnos con Fowell, con un montón de escritores ocultos de nuestra literatura, sin pasar por el realismo mágico, por el boom, por García Márquez, autores que yo considero sobrevalorados y que fueron durante mucho tiempo nuestro único escudo, ¿no? Entonces, creo que él, chiquito, delgadito, joven, enfermo, sin dientes, como Nabokov, como Martin Amy, sí. Porque él perdió muy joven los dientes. No es que luchó, pero se cargó el boom.
No se cuidó.
No, pero quiero decir, se cargó él solo el boom.
Sí.
Se cargó todo un movimiento, ¿no?
Pero hay algunos aspectos del mito que son falsos, ¿no? Es decir, que se dice que era drogadicto y todo eso, ¿no?
Una de las cosas más emocionantes de su biografía es que cuando él llega a Blanes, que es una localidad de la Costa Brava en España, llega para trabajar en un negocio de bisutería que tenía su mamá. Su madre cuenta, su esposa cuenta, sus amigas, toda la obra de Roberto la escribió ahí en Blanes. El gran apego que tenía Bolaño con los heroinómanos y con los toxicómanos en España después de la movida hubo toda una generación que sucumbió frente a la heroína, es decir, desapareció una generación entera, ¿no? Y él los ayudaba, los asistía muchísimo. Bolaño, del famoso manifiesto que lee David, ya desde entonces bebía refrescos. No es cierto ni que bebía, ni que se drogaba, ni nada. Es una lástima, porque sería fantástico que se drogara, que bebiera, y no sé, pero no. Era un hombre muy aficionado a las mujeres. Un insoportable, infiel macho latinoamericano. Que nadie, ninguna de las damas que está aquí hubiera querido tener como novio, realmente. Un patán.
Ah. So Barbara, picking up a little bit of that, we were talking before backstage a little bit about how Bolaño got blown up. Here's this man who has this oeuvre, and only a little bit of it's been translated by when he dies. And you witnessed a little bit of that. You witnessed that blowing up of him, and you also witnessed, you've seen as the years go by, things that have been printed about him that have been false and not corrected.
I was completely fascinated as a small publisher, we're just nine people. When Forrest Strauss took on Savage Detectives, just about the blowing up, like it was completely fascinating to me. Like, it wouldn't have occurred to us to do this. This would have been like 2005, 2006. When did they bring out Savage? It's about 2006. And like they really used social media. They used Twitter. They used Facebook when those were still really groovy in New York. And they made a website just for Bologna. But the best thing they did, well, they did two amazing things. One thing was if you look at the author photo on the Savage Detectives, which he wrote, when he was 40 or 42 or something like that, it's a picture of like a 19-year-old Bologna with like his hair and his face. And he looks like he's been smoking pot. And, you know, it's some hippie kid. And that was incredibly clever to like just bottle up that James Dean thing, and they really did it brilliantly. They did it like just with the photo, like they didn't. And then they had a party that was announced via Facebook and Twitter in a smallish East Village bar that said, if you want to have, you know, hot off the press, the first copies of Savage Detectives, we will give you a tote bag and we'll give you a glass of whiskey. And there were like 3,000 people. I mean, and they were all like 20, maybe 25 years old. And so that completely fascinated me. And I think that's fair. I mean, I think it's great. They totally attracted these young people, and that was terrific. And you know, and they made it to like Time magazine. I mean, they kind of reached past People magazine covered it. I mean, it was kind of the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker and things, the New York Times that pay more attention to our books, LA Times, you know, and it kind of got to just be really blown up. But then after a while, I think certain writers got a little jealous, you know.
That'll happen with writers, they'll get jealous.
And one started floating this canard, and it was successfully picked up by the New York Times and stated as true that Roberto Bolaño was a liar and that he never did go to back to Chile at the time of the coup, which is really a central foundational aspect of his work, going and actually facing things. And another one of our authors, Horacio Castellanos Moya, who was a friend of Bolaño's and also was supported. I mean, he was really supportive of his friends. And he was outraged because he himself is a journalist. And he was like, what's wrong? The journalist in question could read Spanish, and there's published books. Because when he went to back to Chile and got arrested, it really did happen. And his mother's friend was a professor, and that's where he was staying, and she was writing, being worried, and the professor friend was writing back. Now, Bolaño, I mean, you can correct me as a biographer, but according to Horacio, this is all published in books, and these letters exist. And so that the New York Times didn't bother to check this. And then it got picked up by the famous fact-checking New Yorker, and they repeated it. That no, that was just one of he himself was a myth maker, and we're the myth makers, and like the, you know, it's not him. I mean, all writers like to exaggerate and make things up. I mean, that's what you do. But I don't think that he was a liar, and that's always really bothered me, that was allowed. And I did bring it up with the New Yorker, and it was on a blog. But you know, who reads those things? So it's interesting, you know, that. It's just interesting what happens to writers when they're dead and gone and there's nothing that they can do about it. And that whole heroin thing, you know, that one doesn't matter to me as much. I mean, I believe him that he wasn't, you know, I believe the widow and these family friends and Monica. But the thing that, you know, that he was very, I mean, one of the interesting things that I love about his work is this obsession with bravery. And I think he was personally extremely brave. There he is dying. And he's like Francisco says this great thing, well, he was trying to complete 2666. He was in a race with death, and death was cheering him on.
Ben, looking at the work, you know, you as someone who's done, does journalism and has done fiction, you know, looking at specifically at 2666 and some of his other works that have, you know, I mean, novelists report too, right? We go out and we study things and we write about them. I was wondering if you could talk, if you had a chance to think about him as an artist and reporter, you know, because there's this whole huge long section, which a lot of people stop when they're reading 2666 about the femicides in the killing of women in Juarez, and it's devastating to read. And yet you told me, and other people have told me, that he never actually went to Juarez. And did you have a certain, you know, what insights do you have on this sort of, on his technique and what he, you know, was able to do with, you know, in this novel and others where he's based on, you know, some facts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many people have read 2666. I think it's just an extraordinary achievement. And that if you've read it, you know what that section does to you. It sort of takes over your life. And it has this awful vertiginous force. I mean, just this one death after another, each the more brutal than the last. And the landscape gets just sort of thick with death. And you really feel like the weight of all the violence of history building up there, which right. is what I think he wanted to do and did extremely successfully. And what's kind of amazing is, like you said, he was never there. He constructed that mainly through his correspondence with a Mexican journalist and novelist, Sergio González Rodríguez, who wrote the kind of canonical book about the femicides in Juarez, Huesos en el Desierto, Bones in the Desert. And he started writing to him and asking him about the crimes, but asking him just all the questions that he had to fill in the blanks and build this world. And Sergio's not in this room. So I will say the about the crime section of 2666, like, to me, reads as a better piece of writing about those killings than the reporting that Sergio González did, which is just an extraordinary achievement. And perhaps, I don't know what conclusion is to draw from this, except perhaps the degree to which imagination is extremely important in both journalism and fiction.
Well, and imagination is really what, for me, a lot of what his work is about. I mean, he has another passage that to me is extraordinary in that same book, in the first part, in which he does a soliloquy that's from the point of view of a Black Panther, former Black Panther. And, you know, I know a lot of American fiction. You know, I've read a lot of African-American fiction and a lot of African-American, you know, history. And it's extremely convincing. You know, I mean, here's this Chilean, Mexican, Spanish guy who becomes a Black Panther. I mean, that was just extraordinary to me.
Yeah, and I mean, it's extraordinary that the voice is perfect. It's funny. It's absolutely hilarious. But it's hilarious in a way that nonetheless keeps the tragedies of that revolutionary era whole. Like they're never far off of any sentence in that entire section. So you're allowed to laugh at it while, you know, feeling once again the sort of the pain of the 20th century, which is, I think, one of the things that book is about.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. There are stories within stories within stories, and there are novels that he narrates that, of course, don't exist. He has the career of a Nobel Prize nominated writer that he imagines the entire career and it's and his whole life. Also, Dave, can you tell us a little bit, David, about what sort of poetic influences you see in his prose and also in his poetry? And you know, since as a translator, you have to sort of reconstruct. These verses. What influences do you see?
I think there's a lot of. In some sense, it's more about what do you not see? You know, I think especially in his poetry, Bolaño was very reactionary to mainstream Latin American, but especially Mexican poetry, basically post-pass poetry. Mm. And his, you know, The Romantic Dogs, I think, which Barbara published, is a great example. I think Forrest Gander called them remarkably unfinished, something like that. But he meant it as a compliment. They're very, very raw poems, very visceral, you know, the types that the guys that are going to fight Ben after this might aspire to write. I think earlier I mentioned a lot of these sort of obscure writers that might seem highbrow, but I think at the same time he's, you know, quoting Patti Smith lyrics and he's bringing in Los Ovnis, a Mexican rock band. And I think that's one thing that distinguishes his poetry is that, you know, he didn't believe that there was a distinction between the highbrow and the lowbrow. He took it all in and did with it what he wanted.
But the circle of poets in The Savage Detectives, that's one of his books that is really based on a real person. There's a real... Correctness, correcto, ¿no? Que el poeta que es en Los Detectives Salvajes era un amigo de él, ¿no?
Sí, bueno, es toda su juvenilia, ¿no? Lo que hizo Bolaño. Yo lo que quería era responderle a él.
Ah, sí.
Me quiero pelear
claro.
con él.
Okay. She wants to fight with him.
Porque, no, es que me resultó muy interesante lo que dijo. Quería completarlo, ¿no? En realidad estoy muy de acuerdo con lo que dijiste, no es pelearme. Cuando dices que el libro, si entendí bien al chico que me está traduciendo, tú dices que 2666 te controla. Yo creo que ahí está la fuerza de Bolaño, que él nos vuelve a demostrar el gran poder de la literatura.
Sí.
En México, aquí está el editor de Almadía, que es una gran editorial independiente muy importante de los últimos tiempos, puede dar fe de la cantidad de libros sobre el narco, no ficción, ficción, amigos del Chapo, enemigos del Chapo, del cártel de Vieja California, de la Reina del Sur. Nada, ninguno de esos libros, ni uno por libro, ni todos juntos, hablan de lo que realmente nos pasó en estos 6 años. Y si vas a Bolaño, que lo escribió antes de que las cosas pasaran, es probable que encuentres, por lo menos, no sé si todas las claves, pero sí al menos las que necesitas para no volverte loco en medio de ese infierno. Y eso hacen los buenos libros, eso hacen los grandes escritores, ¿no? Era eso lo que quería hacer.
No, voy a responder en inglés a eso, and we'll open it up to conversation too. That to me is that, you take this, really what is one of the most horrific tragedies in North America of the last 25 years is the drug war and the violence and the border. And you, to sort of my own interpretation of what Monica is saying is that we have all these journalists who have tackled this. We have, many, many writers who have tackled it, but it takes somebody with incredible imagination to be able to really tell, to find the truth in that story.
Y sobre todo porque todos esos libros nos plantean qué es lo que van a leer los jóvenes del mañana. La fe que yo tengo es que van a leer en términos de literatura mexicana, y tomo a Bolaño como un escritor mexicano en ese sentido, yo creo que van a leer a Bolaño y van a leer a Daniel Sada. No van a leer nada más. Y eso es muy interesante porque se está publicando muchísima literatura del narco, ¿no?
Pero lo irónico de eso es que a Bolaño leía a todos. ¿Me explico? Él no solo leía a dos personas. No, no solo leía a Nicanor Parra o Neruda o quien sea. Él leía a todos, ¿no?
Y sabía a todos, sí.
I'm just pointing this out, she was saying that this is a writer who is one of the essential writers, but yet he was a voracious reader. He read so much.
Sí, pero todos los escritores que uno tiene la suerte de encontrar son en general lectores más que escritores. No sé si pasa eso. En general es muy común. Digo, Rodrigo Fresán tiene una frase fantástica, es raro, es la segunda vez que lo nombro, no es porque sea argentino, ¿no? Pero él dice que una de las cosas más terribles que le pasan con la muerte, que está convencido, a pesar de que es argentino, de que algún día va a morir, de todos los libros que van a publicar cuando él esté muerto y que no va a poder leer. Y si te lo pones a pensar, es tristísimo. Por otro lado, Rodrigo Fresán era muy amigo de Bolaño y tú le preguntabas a los dos quién leía más de los dos. Y tanto Bolaño como Fresán contestaban que Bolaño decía, yo tengo el este y Fresán tiene el oeste, ¿no? Y entre los dos leían todo.
Barbara, can you tell me, walk me through a little bit before we're going to open up to questions here, the own history of New Directions, what you published by Ned in Chile and what came after that. And, because I know you have, we also have Between Parentheses and several other works. Can you just tell me exactly what New Directions is published of Bolaño?
Yes. Okay, so By Night into the Distant Star, Last Evenings on the Earth, which was the first story collection, which is, I just love this because those were taken from two books in the Spanish which was Assassin Whores and Telephone Calls. Mm-hmm. And it was, it just, I just think, we didn't make the selection. His Anagramma, Harville, and Bologna together made it for, to be appropriate for Anglophone readers. Mm. And then many years later, we published The Return, which was the other stories from both of those collections, and they're all about sex. Like, it's clear The Return is all about sex. I mean, every single one is about sex, necrophilia, prostitution, but every kind of sex. And it's clear that the British publisher didn't want to publish those stories. And so Last Evenings on Earth is fabulous stories, but anyhow, that's just interesting to me. So then we did, after Last Evenings on Earth, we did Amulet, which is a really terrific story, often kind of derided because in parts it seems like an outtake from Savage Detectives, but he didn't think of it that way at all, and it's a terrific, really beautiful novel. We did The Insufferable Gaucho, which is...
Which is the last thing he wrote, right?
Yeah. The last thing that he oversaw the publication of it. Mm. And it's the first time that essays came into English. There's two really landmark essays in there, and five, some of his very, very best stories. And Monsieur Payne, which is another great, great novel. And that is very, very important. After Amulet, actually, I should go back, it was Nazi Literature in the Americas, which is this fantastic made-up encyclopedia of North and South America, fascist writers. And it's fantastic. It's really, really great. Yeah. And it's one of my favorites. And then we did The Return, which are kind of the sex stories. We did The Romantic Dogs, which would have been... I'm sorry, I'm getting all out of order. That would have been after Amulet and before Monsieur Payne. And that was his first collection of poems. And that did really well, and that was kind of riding the wave of the 2666 and the Savage Detectives. People were very curious then because of those poet hero boys, like what his own poetry was like. And it's also really great because his books, for people who read Spanish, weren't up to that point very available, or they were extremely expensive. And so it was the first time Spanish language readers could really have an inexpensive paperback of his poetry. And so that sold really exceptionally well for a poetry book. And it's en face with the English and the Spanish. And then we did Between Parentheses, which is his collected essays. And what else? And then we are about to publish his collected poems, The Unknown University, which is this like...
Wow.
More than 950 pages. Yeah, that's also bilingual, which is, please buy it. It was so so expensive to produce. Printing bills. And we just decided to buy the Lumpen Novelita, which is something else he published during his lifetime. And it's very complicated because there is so much in the archives, but I find it easier when I'm pitching to reviewers and trying to describe to bookstores. It helps a lot to say, not to discredit the stuff that is being found in the archives, but it's very helpful to me to be able to say, he chose to publish Lumpen Novelita. Oh, and we also published Antwerp, which is a short, very poetic novella, which is also, he considered poetry, so it's also inside, it's odd, it's also inside the Unknown University. So I'd say we're up to about 12 books.
Wow.
And they're all really, really remarkable. And a couple of them, particularly like Monsieur Payne and Amulet, because of this, people got, the reviewing community as well as the bookstore people, just felt inundated. It was a lot. It was a lot of Bolaño. And even though his super hardcore fans bought them all, I feel like maybe we should have spaced them out. But we have them on term licenses, and so it's hard not to feel like we should get them out. And so...
Barbara, can I just ask a quick question? As a translator, I wondered how, I know you guys have published poetry translated by Laura Healy, but most of his prose is more or less split, right, between Natasha Wimmers and Chris Andrews. How did they divvy it up? Was there a...
Well, the vast majority of the fiction that we've done is Chris Andrews.
Okay.
And Chris and Bolaño knew each other, and so that was, I think, really helpful and informed those first translations, which he saw. He saw By Night in Chile, and they had a lot of back and forth about that. And I think with some of the stories that went into Last Evenings as well. And I think they thought they were friends as well. And then Natasha really helped us out because when we were doing Antwerp, she was done. She was done with her two big books. And Chris didn't feel like he was quite the right translator for Antwerp, which is a very interesting, strange prose poem as much as it is a novel. And so Natasha wanted to do that. So Natasha did that. And then Natasha did the collected essays. But the vast majority of our fiction is with Chris.
Can I just be a pain in the ass one more time?
Please.
You should all go out and buy every one of those titles, as well as everything else on New Directions lists. And I just want to pose the rhetorical question of when the entire literary culture can only afford to focus on one Latin American writer every 40 years. Like what happens to everybody else? Like, who are we not reading? Because we're all sitting here talking about Bolaño, and what are we not thinking about? What are we not talking about? Right. What perspectives are we not getting? And this is, you know, like, you publish a lot of the people that I wish we were also talking about. But I think there's something very dangerous about the way celebrity culture focuses the way we look at literature. And just had to say that.
Yeah, why don't we have our panelists answer that question, and then we'll go to questions from the audience. What would Bolaño be reading, or what more can we read?
I mean, Bolaño loved the people he loved so much. Like, he was like, and I feel really fortunate because he's a constant gold mine now for our books, because we published Borges, we published Cortazar, we published many of the people he loved in other languages too, like mm-hmm. Rambo, Nicanor Parra, you know, Huidobro, Enrique Lin. I mean, we have these books, and now every time we reprint, there's something else Roberto Bolaño said about these people. And it's not just Spanish language authors. So he had a really wide and interesting fascination with all languages and anything he could get his hands on. And so I'd love to say that he's also wrote fabulous things. You know, he loved Nicanor Parra, he loved Borges. You know, he had a very mixed relationship to Neruda at best. He's one of our best-selling poets. He had a very mixed relationship, but with Javier Marías, up and down. You know, but then he loved, not always, but mostly Cesar Ayra he loved. He really loved Horacio Casanova. You were speaking about Fresson. A lot of people he's helped bring into English. Some of the Farrar Straus authors that are published, I think, are published because of Bolaño's great interest in them and an endorsement of them. I mean, he was kind of a machine for endorsing his friends. And the friends didn't have to be living friends. Some of his friends were writing in the 14th century. Like, you know. So he was terrific. I mean, that's the kind of author you want to publish because it cross-pollinates. And Ben's right. I mean, it's a pity that, you know, but he's opened doors. I have to say, I can't believe The New Yorker published a Cesar Ayra story. And a really crazy Cesar Ayra story. I mean, they're all pretty far out, but really far out one. I mean, I was like, I sent them three stories. I was like, well, that's the one they're never going to publish. And it was like, so, you know, it's interesting. And Harper's did a big story on Ayra, you know. And Horacio's books, especially the first one, got a lot of attention. And he's well on his way to becoming an established writer. That said, none of those people have hit this kind of superstar glamour. And I don't know what the answer is. We do everything. I mean, we jump through hoops. We try everything we can think of.
Mónica, ¿querías responder?
Sí, yo soy muy, muy mal pensada. Y entonces creo que, por un lado, es cierto que en Estados Unidos la literatura latinoamericana solo fue leída a través de la clave del boom, ¿no? Pero también es cierto que la literatura latinoamericana vivió una esclavitud con el boom. Editorial. Yo he visto y he sido testigo y dolorosamente testigo de terribles desprecios, horribles desprecios de parte de los tótem literarios latinoamericanos hacia Bolaño. El único escritor del boom, el más joven, el único escritor presente, además revolucionario literariamente hablando, aunque aplicado a Vargas Llosa, decir revolucionario es una ironía, fue precisamente Mario Vargas Llosa, el único que de todo ese grupo se abrió y dijo, hay que leer a Bolaño. Y fue muy gracioso porque la primera vez que habló de Bolaño dijo, Bolaños, que viniendo de Vargas Llosa, todo un erudito, realmente fue como llamativo. Tan desconocido por entonces era Roberto, ¿no? El resto del establishment literario, desde Antonio Escármeta hasta Sergio Ramírez, estoy dando nombres, me pueden llevar presa en la puerta, niegan a Bolaño. Le hice una entrevista una vez a Antonio Escármeta y me dijo que al que había que leer era a Junot Díaz, no a Bolaño. Y cuando le comenté eso a Junot, me decía, esos escritores machos latinoamericanos que se peleen entre ellos, pero que a mí no me metan.
Wow.
Mucha envidia. Yo creo que Bolaño genera mucha envidia.
We're going to open it up for questions from the audience. And there are a couple of people with microphones walking around, right there. Yes, thank you.
La primera para Mónica, si la hago así rapidísimo. Should I say in English or en español?
Cualquiera de los dos.
Okay, tuve la fortuna de pasar el verano en la Ciudad de México y en una de esas extrañas caminatas por la Condesa muy tarde por la noche, la Condesa es un barrio muy conocido, me encontré a Juan Villoro, que era amigo y es un escritor contemporáneo de Bolaños y que lo conoció, me parece que era como cuate de él cuando estaba en la época de los infrarrealistas y tal. Y no estoy segura, pero me parece que uno de sus personajes está basado en la amistad con Juan Villoro. No sé si
no,
tienes contacto con
sepamos,
él.
No, pero sí fue un amigo muy cercano de Roberto, sobre todo en la última época.
Sí, supe. Bueno, tuve una conversación extrañamente fuera de una cantina, me lo encontré y fue como muy fantástico. Y quería hacer la pregunta si estaba basada en alguno de sus...
No, Juan Villoro habla mucho de Bolaño, fueron amigos muy, muy cercanos, se quisieron mucho y tanto él como Fresán son dos personas que en este momento han decidido dejar de hablar de Roberto. También es un fenómeno que está pasando, digamos, ¿no? Entre los amigos. Pero sí, Villoro ha dado ya varias entrevistas y ha contado varias anécdotas que han... Digo, no quiero extenderme, pero ustedes saben, ¿no?, que hay un grave problema póstumo, ¿no?, con la obra de Roberto, con los derechos y con... No con los derechos, pero sí con cómo se cuenta su biografía a raíz de una... actitud que ha tomado su viuda muy llamativa y que no quiero calificar, pero sí que ha metido mucho ruido, digamos, en el mundo Bolaño, ¿no? Y entonces, en virtud de eso, muchos amigos, entre ellos Juan, se han decidido como clausurar el tema Bolaño, ¿no?
Another question.
Esa era la pregunta. No, sí.
Over here, someone has a question on this side, or I'm sorry, I saw another microphone. Do we have, raise your hands, please, and yes, over here, thank you.
I read somewhere that Bolaño wanted to publish 2666 as five separate novels because he thought that it would earn more money to support his children. I'm just curious, how are his kids doing now? Are things okay with his family? Did they survive?
Monica?
I think they are doing all right.
No. No, está muy bien, muy, muy bien. Lautaro es un chico ya de 18 años, que tiene un grupo de rock, que un extraño privilegio que solamente obró Bolaño desde el cielo fue que cuando hace 2 años la Casa de América organizó un homenaje a Bolaño, vino Patti Smith. Patti Smith ha dicho una frase genial con respecto a Bolaño, a la obra de Bolaño, que a mí me encanta y me encanta repetir, que es, fue quien nos dibujó el apocalipsis, ¿no? Y me parece que es una manera interesante de acercarnos a la obra de Roberto. Y cuando cantó como cierre del encuentro, invitó a Lautaro a tocar. Así que fue muy interesante. La obra de Roberto está generando, por cierto, supongo yo, muchos, muchos beneficios, y su viuda adoptó una postura muy firme, inesperada, que fue sacarle todos los derechos a Anagrama, su gran casa editorial, y venderlos a Andrew Wiley, que es un un agente que le dicen el chacal, así que con eso digo todo. Y ahora hay una cosa muy triste que está pasando con la obra de Roberto, que tiene que ver con... Roberto estaba separado de su esposa durante mucho tiempo antes de morir y tenía una pareja que todos conocen y que todos estiman y que es muy conocida y como parte vital de la vida de Roberto. Y no se sabe por qué, pero en un momento determinado la viuda de Roberto decidió como borrar esta historia de la biografía, ¿no? Que no cuestiona los derechos, porque en realidad Carolina López es la albacea oficial, nadie puede discutirle eso. Y entonces hubo una muestra ahora, hay una muestra ahora en Barcelona, una exposición que tiene que ver con los 10 años de la muerte de Roberto, y entonces todos los amigos de Carmen, la última mujer de Roberto, no aparecen, entonces toda la biografía es fragmentada a tal punto, es así, que no aparece Anagrama en la exhibición, no aparece Ralde, que fue fundamental en la vida de Roberto. No quiero vender mi libro, pero sí.
Pero ellos sí aparecen en el libro.
La última entrevista es a su última mujer. Es realmente terrible lo que cuenta. Y chiquitito cuento la anécdota de que eso de que todo se bolañiza, fue muy difícil convencerla para que estuviera en el libro. Cuando nos encontramos en una esquina, choca un motociclista con un auto y entonces Carmen, que es toda una mujer así grande, solidaria, se va a ayudarlo. La segunda vez, cuando finalmente convencemos y la empezamos a grabar, viene un muchacho y nos saca todos los teléfonos celulares de la mesa, de la Rambla de Barcelona, y todos corriendo atrás del ladrón. Cuando finalmente la convencemos, el relato de Carmen es estremecedor. Como está Carmen en la biografía, no está Carolina. Por eso el libro se llama Una semblanza, porque no pudo ser una biografía entera, porque si falta su mujer, obviamente, ¿qué tipo de biografía es, ¿no? Pero Carmen, el testimonio es de la mujer con el que estuvo el último día, ¿no? Cuando Roberto comienza a descomponerse, y pone en el... Bueno, la anécdota es muy conocida, pero es contada por ella, es estremecedora. Pone en el equipo de música una canción que se llama Lucha de Gigantes, que es un himno a la vitalidad, cantada por un compositor español que murió muy joven, trágicamente, por la heroína. Es decir, todo un escenario. Y cuando llega al hospital, ella lo lleva al hospital para ya nunca salir, ¿no? Entonces era un testimonio fundamental, no podía faltar. Entonces lo que está pasando con Roberto es esto, que si vas con la esposa te queda te cuenta una parte, pero si vas con la novia te cuentan la otra, ¿no? Algo habrá hecho mal en la vida para que ahora póstumamente le estén pasando estas cosas a Bolaño. Anda a saber.
Tenemos tiempo para una pregunta más. One last question we have time for. I'm over there.
Yo hablo mucho.
Sí.
I was just, when you talk about Bolaño as visionary, something I'm really interested in is how he treats fascism in North America, and you see it in several books. And I'm just opening up back to you, how you feel about it and what you see the threads are that he saw.
Are you a fascist? Just so we can know where you're coming from.
I'm the only one wearing a hat.
Any of our panelists want to tackle one?
I think the thing that's really chilling about the earliest novels is how hard he was trying to figure out what happened. So that, you have these narrators and protagonists who are entirely complicit, and he's trying to figure them out and to figure out what their relationship was to writing, to literature, and it's all extremely tangled and unpleasant, and there's not a whole lot of possibility of purity in what he's describing. It's a really painful, almost airless world, which I think we then see again in 2666 in the chapter about the crimes.
I think it's interesting too that, like, even though he shows how terrifying 2666 is, just so horrible, but that he also, I don't know, Muriel Spark always said the best way to deal with the devil is to ridicule him. And there's a lot of ridicule of fascism in overtly, you know. I mean, not the femicide thing is a different part. It's part of it, but that is not ironically handled. But people who embrace fascist ideas, like in Nazi literature and some of the characters in his two big books, they're brilliantly ridiculed. And I do think it's like the best way to deal with people.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you to our four panelists. Thank you to the Los Angeles Public Library and to Aloud and to our wonderful interpreters. And please, books are for sale. And thank you all so much for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.